Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's always fantastic to have you joining us again for another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. We've got a great episode for you, looking at things a little bit differently, and I'll get into that in a little bit here when Sam introduces our guest and bringing back some people that we haven't had on in a while. So before we get to that, got to talk about Sam. So, Sam, I know you're busy, like, finalizing your move to Colorado, but you still made time to get on the show tonight.
Yeah, I've only been here now a year and a half. You'd think I have this done, but I got a few things left in California, and I got to make a run back there and get them, and then I'll officially be 100% in Colorado. So, speaking of Colorado, we have our friend Kyle Nelson, our weather dude, and we just had a real nice storm blow through here. Kyle, what's going on here, and what's the week look like?
Oh, hey, Sam, and good evening to everyone out there in the disaster podcast world. Yeah, definitely, a stormy afternoon here across Colorado. I was up doing some maintenance on a radio tower this morning and was feeling some of those outflow winds coming out of those thunderstorms there as we were up on the tower. So that was interesting. But looking at the weather side of things, kind of taking a look back. First, we had a pretty widespread tornado day on June 28 in the Midwest with over 30 reported tornadoes. And following that on June 29, we had a pretty significant hail day with hail up to half-dollar size in and around the Omaha, Nebraska area. So I have a good friend there who's a meteorologist, and his car was not spared. So, no, we meteorologists cannot control the weather even as much as we wish we could sometimes. The tropics are also back in the news with newly classified Tropical Depression 4, still about 1,100 miles east of the Lesser Antilles, so way, way out there in the Atlantic. And little change in strength is expected over the next 48 hours. It's probably going to dissipate, and that's what we're hoping for, so keep your fingers crossed for that. But looking ahead, closer here in the mainland, much above normal temperatures persisting for the western half of the U.S., and heavy rain threat increasing for the southern Great Lakes region early next week. So that's a quick look at the disaster weather roundup. Sam, back to you.
Wow. Well, just keep it clear between here and California tomorrow so I can get there without running into hail. I think hail scares me more than anything. So, because you never know. Yeah, like you said, it takes out cars. So that's not a good thing. Well, we're going to have some fun tonight. Most of you, if you've been listening to this podcast at all, you know our friend Kevin Ryder, our wilderness expert out of Texas. And we've been chatting lately because he's kind of taken the disaster podcast, Dr. Joe's with us also, kind of into some other podcasts. He was listening to one he can tell us about that was kind of a prepper podcast, and he heard some things that made the hair kind of stand up on the back of his neck, and he went, oh, my God, that is not accurate. And people that do that can have a problem. So he actually got on the podcast with them and had a discussion. And one guy came along and said, you know, that was a really good response to that. Well, we have that guy on here too. And that guy, Brian Duff, just started his own podcast, which we're very anxious to hear about. And Brian himself has quite a background that we can tell you about. And maybe we can hear some of his stories a little bit later. So Kevin, hi there.
Howdy. Wait, let me redo that. I'm in Texas now. Howdy, y'all.
Why better? Do you still sound like better? You're from New Jersey? I don't know. Anyway, so...
How you guys doing over here?
There you go. That's better. So introduce us to Brian and how you got to know him, and then we'll talk about some prepper stuff.
Sure. One of the podcasts I listen to on occasion is called the Survivalist Prepper Podcast. And both Brian and myself listened to it, and not particular to this specific podcast, but in general among the prepper community, there seems to be a fascination about suturing whenever medical skills get brought up. And I made a quick comment to Dale, it's a good one, the creator of the podcast. I said, hey, just, you know, so you know, that isn't really a good thing to talk about. Long story short, he had me on as a guest. I addressed that, and I'll send Jamie the link to include on the podcast notes if you want to go listen to that. But it was really good. And then after the podcast aired, there was a question or something about that. And then Brian gave me some really awesome kudos that made me feel really good, and I could relax a little bit. But yeah, I did it very non-confrontational, just very educational from a viewpoint that most people don't think about, that we all think about, because we got to deal with the after effects of anything we do in relation to a patient and the care that we provide that typically isn't mentioned or brought up or even thought about. So that's how I approached it. And I, so far, have met with good comments about it. But it's basically, why don't you want to suture? You know, leave it to a doc. They're the guys trained in it. And that led to an entire podcast about, I afraid it was a half hour or an hour episode, just about medical skills and wilderness medicine and survival in general and a few other things, which led to a second podcast episode about the difference in medical skills between like an EMT, a paramedic, a PA, a nurse, and a doctor. And that's about the time that I was introduced to Brian. And I'll let Brian explain his background, because it kind of blows me away. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Brian.
Well, thanks, Kevin. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me here tonight. I'm really glad to be here. As far as my background goes, you know, I grew up in Southern California, and I started off in the YMCA Indian Guides and Boy Scouts, and it kind of got me into first aid. Became a lifeguard after that for a while, where they, you know, I was 16 years old. They trained me in CPR and again, more first aid and all that. And it was just like, wow, this is pretty cool. So when I went off to college, I took a EMT course, and people started talking about the fire department, like, hey, you can become a firefighter and all this. So I said, all right, well, how do I become a firefighter? And they said two ways at the time: go to the fire academy or become a paramedic. I said, well, I really like this medicine. So I went off and went to Daniel Freeman out in LA and became a paramedic. Interned in South Central, worked in Southern California as a firefighter paramedic up until the early mid 90s. At that time, I decided to move on and I joined the Army. And when I went into the enlistment center, they asked me what I wanted to do. And they had two pictures on the wall, one guy driving a tank and a guy jumping out of an airplane. So they said, well, we don't have any tank driving positions, but we might be able to get you in the infantry. And I didn't know what I was doing. So yeah, okay, I'll join the infantry. And then they got me jumping out of the plane. And next thing I know, I became an Army Ranger. I was with 3rd Ranger Battalion for a good number of years in the mid 90s. Left there, kind of bounced around for a little bit, found my way back into EMS. I was working in Atlanta doing EMS for Great EMS in Atlanta. And my partner at the time started speaking about people that were going overseas and working as security contractors and paramedics and otherwise. Told me how to do it. Next thing I know, I made a phone call, and within, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 months, I found myself, it was 2004, I found myself in Afghanistan. And ever since then, I worked in Afghanistan. I did years, I think I have a little bit over 2,000 days on the ground in Iraq. I worked South Sudan, Pakistan, some other countries. Did that to about 2 years ago when I came home. And during that time, I got my education. I went, got my bachelor's in security management, and then got my master's, my MBA, and obviously in business, and came home, and I'm a director for a large security company that has a large overseas security program. And that's so, brought us.
Jamie, we could do a 3-hour podcast just on Brian's adventures, of which there are many.
Yeah.
We may have to have him back a couple of times to get all of that in. So, wow, that's incredible. I mean, guys like you, thanks. we've talked to the medic that started Trek Medics. That's who you remind me of. It's kind of start small with an interest in going overseas and helping people out. And the next thing you know, there's this huge conglomeration that they're running. So I give you guys kudos for hanging in there and doing your best to help people.
I appreciate it.
And I could tell you've got the awesome podcaster microphone. So you sound really good up there.
Oh, thank you.
So Kevin and Brian both, I think for the benefit, we talked about this earlier, but a lot of people don't understand exactly what a prepper is. And something you told me earlier, there's like 7 levels, of which we will, all of us in this podcast, will fold into one of them. So can you tell us what those are real quick?
Sure. So again, that other podcast, kind of broke it down, and it breaks the stereotype. Not all preppers are the doomsday preppers you see on TV. Most people are preppers without even realizing it. For example, if you live in the Northeast, you know every year you're going to get pelted with a ton of snow. You're probably going to lose power for a little bit. You may be stuck inside for a day or two. Hopefully it's during the week so you get paid from work if you can't make it into work. Or you're in Tornado Alley, or you have lots of just natural disasters in the area that you live in. So without even thinking about it, you know, hey, I might lose power. Let's make sure we have a good stock of canned food or some kind of food, a generator in case the power goes out. I saw that a lot during Hurricane Sandy. You couldn't find a generator within a 200-mile radius. People were traveling out to Ohio from New Jersey just to buy a generator to bring back in preparation for Hurricane Sandy. And they were all put to good use because there were people that were without power for a good couple of weeks. So those kind of preppers, you're preparing for what you know can and will happen, but you're not a doomsday prepper. There's closet preppers who don't want to tell anybody because they feel they're going to get, you know, there's some kind of stigma attached to being labeled a prepper. So there's seven different types of preppers. I don't remember all of them exactly, but it runs the gamut from, you know, somebody who does it on occasion, you know, they're prepping for financial reasons. I don't want to lose my job, or what happens if I lose my job? I don't want to lose my home. So I'm going to make sure and get all my bills taken care of, pay off my house, get rid of my credit card debt. It runs the gamut, and it's different for everyone. But I'll let Brian take it from here. He's a much better speaker than I am, and he's more eloquent and can wax and wane some of the more major differences in some of the prepping community. So, Brian, have at it.
Ah, thanks, Kevin. Man, I really, I better make sure I hit it after that intro from you. But no, Kevin hit it right on the money. You know, most people are preppers without understanding they're preppers. I mean, preppers, the history of prepping, it goes back to ancient times. I mean, people, you know, throughout history have prepared, especially before all the modern conveniences, they prepared just to get by. They knew winter was coming. Hey, we have to stock up salt, meat. We have to do all this and get ready because when winter hits, there's not a 7-Eleven, there's not a Safeway I can go down the street and grab the food from or do whatever we need to. So we need to be ready. And if they didn't, the downside of failure for them was they died, or they had, you know, or family members died, had a really bad time. So that went up through like around World War I, World War II, you kind of had that initial sort of prepping mindset. In World War I, World War II, people got behind the prepping movement in terms of trying to help the war efforts, right? So you had, you know, I think it started actually in World War I, but it really took off in World War II, was grow a victory garden. The government encouraged people to go out and grow their own vegetables. And I think a lot of people found that they could grow enough vegetables by putting in the work to almost get them fed year round. And that relieved the amount of food that they, you know, we were short food. So they were limited on what they could send to the troops. So this way, by putting it on the people were part of the war effort. They had buy-in and all that. That goes all the way up through the 1970s and stuff. A lot of that mindset came on. And actually in the 1950s, we ran into the Cold War, the threat of Armageddon with nuclear war with Russia and all that. So you had people that started building bunkers and stocking food in bunkers saying, hey, you know what? If I have any chance of having my family and myself survive, I want to survive this. So flash forward up until the 1980s. Well, in the 1980s and the late 70s, you started to have the survivalist, more of a survivalist movement come on. And that's where you had like Jeff Cooper and the gun community were getting big into shooting sports and this and that. And some of these went really off kind of far on the right side, and which kind of opposed, I guess, some of the media that was more on the left. So they started getting a stigma attached to it. Like, hey, these crazy people go out in the desert and they shoot guns, or they want to prepare for Armageddon and this and that. So there's a stigma that was attached to that. And I think that kind of climaxed in just after around 2000 or so, whenever the Doomsday Preppers show came out, where there's hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of preppers in the United States, and they choose kind of these people who personify the extremes of prepping. And I think that kind of that caused a lot of people to say, oh, my gosh, you guys really are crazy. Well, then you flash forward even farther to where we're at today. You know, society's anything but stable today. So you have people that are concerned about economy. that are either conserving their money or investing in silver and gold. You have people concerned with the terrorist incidents that are happening and different crime that's happening around. I know this weekend or this week, I believe the G20 summit starting in, I think it's Hamburg, and they have 100,000 people descending to protest these G20. So, and we have that capability here in the States of violence or protests happening. So you have a lot more people are going, you know what, maybe there is something to trying to be prepared. And like Kevin said, there's different levels of preparedness. And Dale Goodwin over on survivalsprepper.net wrote a good article, blog post recently about it. And he went through kind of what Kevin said. You have the extreme prepper who they're more of the old school preppers that kind of they pick one sort of doomsday or two doomsday scenarios. And that's what they convince themselves. This is what's going to happen. That's what they prepare for. Then you have the more of the open-minded prepper that looks at it like, hey, I really don't know what's going to do me in, if I'm going to be, anything's going to happen. And that's kind of where I fall into is, you know, we may never, and I hope we never have a doomsday scenario. I hope there's never an EMP or anything major that impacts the world or the U.S. But what I do know is Hurricane Katrina hit and it caused a lot of problems. Hurricane Sandy hit and it caused a lot of problems. Growing up in Southern California, I went through some pretty big earthquakes. So people should be ready for short-term events. And I think the government recommendations is like have 3 days of food and water stocked up so you can get by on your own. I recommend having more. I mean, look at Hurricane Katrina. I mean, people were stuck down there for a while without food and water. So you go from the open-minded prepper to the gateway prepper, which is a new prepper. Something or someone got them interested in it, and they like the idea of, hey, I feel better by knowing I can withstand or I can weather some tragic events or some difficult times. You also have the survivalists that we talked about earlier. The modern day survivalists are more of people who, if they think if things are going to go bad, that they can go out to the woods and survive in the woods, the bushcraft type of people. And then a lot kind of combining in all these is the closet prepper. A lot of people are concerned that if they tell somebody they're a prepper, everybody's going to think that they're stockpiling guns and ammo, food and water, and that there's a crazy person living next door to them. So a lot of people that are preppers, for a couple of reasons. For that reason, they don't say it. And then they're also concerned that, hey, if something does happen and everybody knows I have a year's worth of food, I know where they're coming. So they kind of keep it quiet and they kind of stay in the prepping closet on that. So that's sort of the background on a lot of the whole prepping world.
So we're hardly closet preppers because we preach disaster preparedness all the time, just being ready for basically anything. And of course, like Kevin alluded, each area of the country has its own distinct type of natural event that is likely to occur. So people prepare for that. So would we be considered preppers on some level?
You know, I think depending on where you live, like, so I live in the metropolitan DC area. I think there's some people here that would probably say, oh yeah, you're preparing for that stuff. You know, why would you worry about that? The local authorities will help you out. We had a snowstorm here a year ago this past March, and being from Southern California, I didn't grow up in a snow area. And so it was my first big experience with like a 3 or 4 foot dumping of snow. 4 days before the snowstorm hits, I go to the supermarket. I still have pictures of it on my iPhone. There's nothing in the supermarket. It's empty. Everybody rushed in at the last minute. And when I spoke to some people, they don't have any food in their house. They're like, man, I don't have enough food to get by for a day. So in a way, could you be considered a prepper? I guess, but you know, I look at it as just more of having common sense mindset. You know, everybody has family, friends, and whatever. I have probably a year or two worth of food, freeze dried, dehydrated food and stuff in my garage. You know, well, can I survive for a year or two on that? Yeah, hopefully, if it's an event that's big, I imagine I'm gonna have bigger problems than that. But the thing is, if it happens, if something goes on for a week, I can feed my neighbors, I can feed my friends and my buddies like that. So I look at it as more of a common sense. It's just like, you know, I know you were in EMS and people are in EMS and that work in the ERs, and a lot about what, you know, the disaster podcast is about just making sure you're ready to survive an event if it happens. And that's where I think a lot of preppers are. Some look at more of the long-term events. Well, what if this happens? What if, you know, a Carrington effect, which Carrington effect was a mass coronal ejection, basically a solar flare that hit the U.S., I believe, back in the late 1800s. And scientists today say if that would have hit today, it probably would have downed our power grids. So there's a lot of people focus on that and say, hey, I want to be ready to survive if something like that happens. So it's just all degrees of, I believe, what's in a person's comfort zone. What do they believe they need to do to be prepared? And that's what they shoot for. But to answer your question, yeah, I think there's some people who would think you're being a prepper a little bit.
Well, I guess that's okay. So here's a thought. I'll throw this to Dr. Joe since he's been sitting patiently out there. I actually was reading a book the other day that speculated that bartering will actually kind of come back. And I couldn't tell you all the reasons for that, but it's a thing where, you know, people, something Kevin said made me think about it, where, you know, people will barter crops and just different things. You got one of the, you got apples, I got corn. I don't know. What do you think about that idea, Joe? Do you think that's feasible?
Well, I do. You know, I think certainly, I think the idea of bartering is certainly not uncommon and goes on all the time. And I think to some extent we do that with our neighbors all the time. I'll mow your yard if you'll let me borrow your lawnmower. You know, I mean, those are all bartering type transactions. And, you know, I think it really just has to do to some extent with sort of the scale of your concerns. And you know, as I was listening to sort of the definition of the prepper community, you know, I think that's a very broad spectrum from people that think, you know, that the world is, you know, going to have some apocalyptic crisis in the next 5 years and they're going to be living underground in a nuclear wasteland, to, you know, folks that sort of take the approach of, you know, prepping for things that are perhaps more frequently occur. And I think it's just all a matter of degrees. And, you know, I think that prepper community to some extent has to be cognizant of the fact that some people look at them as, you know, apocalyptic folks that think the world's going to end pretty soon. And, you know, it may. But having said that, I think the approach of preparation and all that sort of stuff is completely reasonable. I think it really is just a matter of, in addition to that, let's make sure that our energy and money and resources that are spent on preparation are being spent in a direction of things that are much more likely to occur, i.e. a hurricane, you know, bad weather. You know, it's hard enough to get people to prepare for earthquakes, which occur with some frequency, I suppose. But, you know, if you look at preparations on the New Madrid Fault, it's been 150 years since we had a significant earthquake here, and people don't think much about it anymore. And, you know, it's what's your timeline of outlook for your preparatory activities and sort of keeping all that in perspective, I think.
So, Joe, one of the main things we were talking about was the medical side of this and what people assume they need to know and can do in what they consider a disaster situation. And the big issue that Kevin dealt with was people thinking, well, if there's a disaster, I'm going to go. They think bleeding control means suturing. And Kevin, of course, spent a lot of time straightening that out. But what's your take on that?
Well, I applaud him thoroughly for that. You know, I think that really is very much of a similar kind of situation where, you know, I mean, as I was listening to him talk about that, you know, the picture that came to my mind is, you know, here's Rambo with a laceration on his arm, and he's got, you know, the suture in his teeth, and he's sewing himself up without anesthesia, and that's, you know, ultimate macho, blah, blah, blah. But I think he's exactly right. You know, that's a skill that has some value, but is that the best way to control bleeding in most cases? No. And there's a lot easier ways of doing things now, and there's a lot of complications to suturing and bad suturing. And stuff that I think people don't appreciate. And you know, then as I listened to him talking about the differences between, you know, an EMT and a medic and others, I think a lot of that is the sort of the further you move up that chain, the more you appreciate the consequences and the stuff that can go wrong and the subtleties and the complexities. And when you don't have much insight or experience with that, you tend to minimize the dangers and maximize the benefits. And, you know, again, it sounds like it's something I ought to learn how to do. I could easily take care of that myself. And that's not to say that they couldn't do it, but I think in the big picture, there are potentially a lot of other approaches to a problem like that that are less risky, less resource intensive, and you know, might result in the same outcome for much less effort, concern, work, complications, et cetera.
Yeah, basic bleeding control. Jamie, I think you have a question for Brian. Yeah,
Brian, I'm just curious, out of curiosity, what's the outlook or the feeling about organized first aid classes, like for preppers taking something like a CERT training class from their local Department of Emergency Services, or taking a formalized wilderness first aid class, for instance?
I think there's a lot of positive thoughts on that. You know, matter of fact, in the in Dale Goodwin's podcast group, there was just some people in there, I think this week, talking about a CERT class that they were taking, and there's a few in there have taken them, and that they've advised other people to take them, and there's a lot of positive response across the board. You know, I think the prepper community really gets behind the medical side of things. And, you know, I was really glad. It's when I reached out to Kevin on the suturing part, was where, you know, he kind of pushed back on the suturing, because everybody wants to do it because it's the big flashy thing, but it's not the realistic thing. You know, they don't have training. And so with people like Kevin out there pushing it, and obviously, your podcast here, is I think some of these people are starting to pick up on the fact that I need to learn the basics, try to advance myself from there. At the end of the day, you need higher level medical care to be able to provide stuff to this. And you know, it's just, they have, I think some people get these dreams of grandeur that this cataclysmic event's going to happen and they're going to be able to go out there and save the world because they're able to suture and have some medical training, when that's, you know, unfortunately that's anything but the case. As far as the training goes, there's a lot of good response to people doing training.
Absolutely. Training is probably the one thing you're going to hear us talk about on virtually every podcast. So, Kyle, any thoughts?
Well, lots of thoughts up to this point. I mean, Brian, this discussion has been great so far, but I, one of the things, I teach a lot of natural hazard preparedness courses across the nation, and I think this kind of plays into kind of what you're trying to do with your podcast and through the outreach and education that you're doing. So if you have someone that comes to you and says, well, I want to be prepared too, I mean, what steps would you take for kind of advising them on how to get started? I mean, they want to probably, it's like, well, I want to be prepared for anything and everything that can affect me. But how do you narrow that scope for folks, and how do you help them narrow that down?
Well, I start off with usually tell them, well, you know, look at yourself. What do you have around your house? If there's, you know, if we're talking just some sort of disaster situation, you know, hey, do you have enough food, long-term storage food, whether it's canned food or whatever, to get you by for an event for, you know, was it 3 days, 5 days, you know, in a case of Hurricane Katrina, maybe you need to be ready for a couple of weeks. Then it's, you know, look at your physical. I tell people about physical fitness, like, hey, what are you doing? You know, I mean, you see a lot of people out there running that aren't fit, especially in the U.S. today. And it's like, if a major event has to happen, and you have to walk out, are you in shape to do that? You know, you can do all the preps in the world you want, get all the food and water and everything together, but if you keel over from a cardiac arrest on the way out the door because you're out of shape, well, that's going to be a problem. So I tell people, go see your doc, you know, find out what your level of health is, and then get on a program. Talk to them about a program. Say, hey, I want to do something. And even if it's just going out and walking, that's doing something more, watching your diet a little bit more, getting better. But really start with the basics. You know, see where you're at. Start with the basics and just do building blocks that build from there. And rather than focus on one type of event, because some people get hung up on that, focus on what will cross, you know, get you across all kinds of different events. If you stock up on food for a week's worth of food, that's something you can eat going on before it goes bad. So it's really not a big expense to you because you're just recycling it into your food plan. And then kind of just go with, I try to get a lot into situational awareness. I think a lot of people have their phones, their heads buried in their iPhones these days, walking around, instant messaging, hopefully listening to our podcast and all that. But at the same time, they need to pick their head up and see what's going on around them, and seeing what's happening in the world around them. Whether, you know, are you being followed, Or is that car that's coming down the street looking like it's getting a little bit too close to the curb? I mean, we've all worked in EMS pretty much or at some point. How many times have you run into someone who they were in the sick predicament they were in because they didn't pay attention? And that's a big one. Just pay attention to what's going on around you. You know, hey, is Hurricane Katrina coming? You might want to get out of the city a little bit ahead of time. So that's kind of where I go with my mindset. Just I really try to take it from the basics and tell people to use building blocks and just common sense and pay attention.
I love it. Yeah. It's more of the practical approach. You know, like you said, using what you have, keeping your physical self prepared, and then just kind of keeping your head on a swivel, as we say, or keeping our situational awareness very sharp. So I love the practical approach. Thanks.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and just want to let you know that we're going to split this episode into two pieces. So you'll want to come back next week for the second half of this episode with Brian Duff and his experiences in the prepper world, and sharing with us as well some of his experiences in episode two of this two-parter on some of the things he saw while in Africa and the Middle East as a contract paramedic over there, working in war zones and austere environments. So check that out in next week's episode. Special thank you, as always, to Paragon Medical Education Group for sponsoring the Disaster Podcast. You know, if you want to bring top-level, amazing training for disaster preparedness that fits your community's specific needs, you can't go wrong with Paragon Medical Education Group. So check them out. You can find them on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com. You can also find them at paragonmededu on Twitter, and they have a Facebook page as well. So look them up, reach out to them, just check them out. They've got a great video that explains what they do and how they do it over on their website. And you really need to look into this. Share it with your training officer and let them know that this is somebody they should really look at how they can bring them into their system. Anyway, that's it for me. For Sam Bradley, Kyle Nelson, Kevin Ryder, Brian Duff, and Dr. Joe Holly, I want to thank all of you for checking out this episode. Make sure you come back next week for part two. And remember that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.